The Cumulative Risk Assessment Seminar Series is leading up to the internal EPA workshop being held July 28 to 30 at the EPA Region 5 offices in Chicago. The workshop is being sponsored by the Office of Science Policy within EPA's Office of Research and Development. It will bring scientists and researchers from across EPA's regional offices, program offices, and research laboratories and centers to move cumulative risk assessment forward by discussing tools, methodologies, and applications, and by identifying research needs and obstacles to practice. Today's seminar will be presented by Dr. Tim Barzyk. Dr. Barzyk works in the National Exposure Research Laboratory of EPA's Office of Research and Development. One of his primary interests is to develop screening-level models that quickly and accurately assess the environmental stressors impacting communities. This work often involves looking at exposure surrogates, things that can tell a lot about exposure and risk short of taking actual concentration measurements. Exposure models provide many of the components and insights into this work. A related interest of Dr. Barzyk is development of comparative risk indices. Such indices would allow comparative ranking of various types of environmental stressors and yield a better idea of the integrated or combined risk of being exposed to them. The EPA and other groups have developed a number of tools to aid with environmental issue identification, prioritization, and mitigation that can be used for exposure and risk assessments performed for or by communities. Today, Dr. Barzyk will present an overview of the currently available tools, including their benefits and limitations and current research needs. Tim and his colleagues have assessed over 70 EPA tools based on criteria developed through a survey of project officers who work directly with community groups across the nation. Their results indicate that current tools are developed fairly independently of one another. Because a single tool providing a cumulative risk assessment would be a useful decision-making tool for stakeholders and partners, Dr. Barzyk has identified development of such a tool as an area for further research. So without further ado, Tim Barzyk, Dr. Tim Barzyk, and please make sure your phone is not on mute.
Thank you. I believe it's not on mute. Thank you very much. Thanks very much for the introduction. Welcome, everybody, to the seminar. I look forward to presenting this information. I'll be presenting an overview of these publicly available assessment tools. So the title of the presentation has changed somewhat because many of these tools might aid with gathering information about environmental stressors or identifying certain ones in a community. Many of them do focus on exposure and risk. However, they don't all do that, but they all basically feed into what could be used within a community exposure or risk assessment framework. This presentation is based on a paper titled Tools Available to Communities, so they are publicly available, for conducting cumulative exposure and risk assessments. So in terms of conducting them, they kind of feed into these cumulative exposure and risk assessments. This paper is in press in the Journal of Exposure Science and Environmental Epidemiology. I have a link and contact information that where I can provide proofs of the paper if people are interested, and I believe they're actually on the CLUIN website as well. The paper, I put together the paper's lead author, the contributing authors who provided a lot of input towards this formulation include Catherine Conlin, Teresa Shaheen, Davida Hammond, Valerie Zartarian, and Brad Schultz, and numerous other people who I'll acknowledge later provided very valuable input. Now, the term tools is really an umbrella term that can cover a wide range of things available to people. And examples of that are here on this title slide. You can see a GIS map of concentrations at the county level for the entire nation. It can also be the middle picture, a guidance document, an actual booklet that describes a process for assessing a given stressor within a community or within your area. Another example are databases of information where you could just type in, you know, the information you're looking for and get an output in this list of, like, locations and concentrations and information like that that's just housed in these data warehouses. So moving on to the second slide, to frame this issue, there are several issues within a community setting. However, there are many separate tools that address them. So in this visualization of the Chicagoland area, one might be interested in air pollution or dietary considerations such as pesticides in the vegetables. Or one might also be looking at these community stressors from a health perspective, like community asthma cases, and what are the primary pollutant drivers that drive asthma. Might be interested in mobile sources or diesel emissions. Or if you're near a coastal or a waterway, you could be interested in mercury contamination within fish, especially if you rely on fish or for a primary part of your diet. Or also just if you're at the beach, you could be very interested in clean shorelines and E. coli breakouts at a local beach. So there are a whole host of things that could be impacting a community. That's why we use the communities as researchers, as case studies, as examples of all the myriad issues that need to be addressed and tools that need to be developed, or how current tools can be applied to address this wide range of issues. So communities provide a very broad and yet focused framework for the idea of cumulative exposure and risk assessments, and the various issues that can be impacting communities are often the same ones that need to be considered in a cumulative assessment. So moving on to slide 3, once you have all these, and once you're looking at all these different stressors, you might find these different tools, like I said before, several issues but separate tools. If all the information is in separate tools, compiling the information can be quite challenging. The further challenge beyond compiling the information is actually interpretation of it. So these two images are examples from a paper that's currently in review by Davida Hammond et al., where national databases and mapping tools have been applied at the local level to two different community case studies. So on the left is the Wayne County area around Detroit, Michigan, and there were three national databases where information was pulled in order to compile this GIS map. One is the National Emissions Inventory, and that information included the top 5 benzene-emitting facilities. We also have air quality monitors for benzene that recorded concentrations for 2007, and information from the National Scale Air Toxic Assessment of Total Lung Cancer Risk. So this map is trying to provide an idea of the benzene concentrations, the primary sources of benzene, and the cancer risk associated with benzene. So again, the interpretation of these is a cautionary aspect, because the information is plotted as an overlay does not necessarily imply that the sources are driving the cancer risks, for example. However, providing this information in a very visual way can be very informative and help with narrowing down the primary risk drivers within a community and within a cumulative setting, because you can put so much information kind of in one place and provide an overview to help people make informed decisions. However, the GIS map itself was a fairly significant undertaking in a sense of just gathering and putting all the information together. And without technical training, it definitely could be a challenge. The map on the right, for example, plots the NADA total diesel concentrations for this area in Holyoke, and the striped areas are the top 30% of total asthma cases as provided by the local public health agency. So again, one needs to be careful in terms of interpretation, but again, it does provide a pretty visual representation of what's going on in terms of diesel concentrations and asthma cases. And without a rigorous analysis, one can see that many asthma cases do occur in the higher concentration areas. And so, you know, addressing asthma or addressing diesel emissions could prove to be a valuable endeavor in terms of addressing a particular issue. So moving on to slide four, some of these available tools that we were looking at, and I'll talk about these in more detail later, include these publicly available GIS mapping tools. So these are tools where you basically enter your zip code and they'll visually display on a map, like primary sources or air concentrations of pollutants within a given geographic area. Databases, which have basically an online query function where you can input the information that you want and it will provide you with output. Guidance documents, which again are booklets designed to provide basically a step-by-step process for addressing a given issue. And exposure models, which basically model the interaction between a human receptor and a chemical concentration within the environment. And these, as you can see from the images here, can be quite complicated, really, the exposure models. The link below, which is also provided at the end of the presentation, has the tables of all these different types of tools available to people with their attributes and availability. So the tables that describe these tools are available at this link. The next slide, five, describes the scientific tools. So this is a comparison between these sort of publicly available tools, the GIS mapping, the guidance documents, databases, and the exposure models, and these more scientific tools that might be used primarily by researchers. They could be used for a community case study, but they're not necessarily used within the broader context of providing a cumulative risk or exposure assessment within communities. These may include measurements or a more rigorous measurement program that would include collecting measurements, analyzing them, and interpreting their results. However, Medina Vera et al. In 2009, they did address and publish tables of publicly available test kits that could be used within this community framework to provide a broader, more screening-level assessment of concentrations within an area, and that reference is provided later. Biomarkers are another tool that can be used by the scientific community for performing assessments, but are generally not used within a community framework. Modeling is another tool, but often requires a lot of technical training and model inputs in order to accurately perform the models and interpret their results. And epidemiological analyses can also be quite powerful tools. However, conducting a rigorous epi analysis and interpreting the results is quite challenging and generally reserved for a more technical population. But the ongoing question when thinking about these community tools is how can components of these tools, of these scientific tools, be used by or for communities to help with a cumulative risk assessment? For example, how can components of epidemiology be used within the cumulative risk framework, be incorporated into tools that can provide sort of a screening level assessment to help identify the main environmental stressors, prioritize them, and then take action to mitigate them? So slide six, this provides more of a list of issues that have been identified as very important to consider in a cumulative risk assessment, especially with a community focus. This list was gathered from 10 references, which I'll mention in more detail later, and the references include EPA reports, regional assessments, so an assessment of a particular region in the United States, and CARE program documents, which is the Community Action for a Renewed Environment, which is a grant program provided by the EPA, and I'll also discuss that in a bit more detail later. Now, this list just focuses on chemical-related community concerns and not necessarily like health drivers or particular sources or other non-chemical stressors. However, this list is actually being expanded upon in a publication of its own by Hammond et al. But the 10 references that were used to compile this list, the main environmental stressors, based on the number of references that address them, include diesel exhaust, drinking water, lead, particulate matter, and radon. But you can see that the host of chemical-related community concerns is quite vast, and any given community might have any combination of these concerns impacting it. So once we identified kind of the next slide, slide 7, this describes the methodology that we use to, you know, gather information about, you know, what tools are we going to look at? How are we going to assess them? How are we going to, like, narrow our focus and actually provide, like, you know, a useful assessment to guide, you know, our own research in terms of developing new tools or understanding how current tools can be used within a community framework. For example, those maps that I had shown before in the two community case studies, a paper is being worked on right now to provide the step-by-step methodology that was used to compile those so that they can be translated across communities and reproduced. But in terms of the methods, we really drew a lot from the Community Action for a Renewed Environment, the CARE program. The CARE program is an EPA program that provides funding across the country. It began in 2005, and they have two levels of grants. The level one grants are primarily focused on identifying the environmental stressors within their community, and the level two grants have already identified a problem and are working to mitigate it. So the technical assistance comes in the form of a project officer within an EPA region who works directly with the community groups to help them work through their environmental problems. So we conducted a survey of all these project officers, and that's another publication that's actually in review now, to provide us with their perspective on the issues that they're dealing with, the tools that they find are important, or the research needs that they feel are lacking and need to be addressed. We focused on the chemical-related environmental concerns, so we didn't do non-chemical stressors, and we didn't necessarily focus on the health effects per se as the initiating factor, but more on these chemical-related concerns. And we focused on tools that identified them, identified the chemical-related concerns, provided information on them, prioritized the concerns, or provided some method for ranking or prioritizing them, or providing a mitigation process or a quantification of mitigation efforts, for example, before and after effects of reducing air emissions. These tools needed to be publicly, so these were some of our criteria. These tools needed to be publicly available, which is why the web-based GIS tools were included, the guidance documents, databases, and the exposure models were all considered for this assessment of current tools. Another resource that's available is this CARE resource guide available at the CARE website, which I'll have on the reference slide later. And that actually provides additional tools that can be used within a community-based setting, and that also provides tools for community participatory research, so forming partnerships and maintaining and sustaining the partnership throughout the process. So that provides additional tools that we didn't include. In terms of compiling all these tools, so once we found they're publicly available, chemical-related, GIS, documents, databases, exposure models, we performed a web search of not only EPA sites, but just broadly. We spoke with CARE project officers and CARE collaborators. We bounced ideas off the Community-Based Technical Support Forum, which is an interagency group that focuses on developing tools for community-based research. We also spoke with program and regional offices and community-based cumulative risk assessment researchers in general to get sort of an idea of the universe of tools that were available. And because so many tools really are available in so many different forms, we not only focused them on chemical-related publicly available tools, but we also focused on the EPA tools. Because, one, they provide a pretty good overview of the types of tools that are generally available, and two, we're confident of the review process that they underwent prior to distribution. So the summary tables that describe the attributes of the different tools and where they're available include 20 different GIS tools, 17 guidance documents, 28 databases, and 13 exposure models, for a total of 78 tools that we looked at. Now, for each of these tools, once they were identified, you know, we tested them out, we included our zip code, we flipped through the guidance document, we compared it to others that were available. And some of the criteria as we went through were, you know, how easy is it to use? How relevant is the information based on what we know, you know, communities as a case study are interested in addressing? Do they address those issues? What types of output do they make? I mean, do they provide maps? Do they provide lists? Is the output compatible across tools? How can the output be incorporated into a GIS framework? How can it be used in other ways? And also something that's very important is really interpretation of results. So do they provide supporting information such that once you have results or once you have this information in hand, how do you make sense of it? How do you present it to a broader audience? So in terms of the discussion topics that we address, we looked at the current use of these tools. Are they currently being used and how? We looked at the intersection of the tools and the issues. So again, are the tools addressing the issues that have been identified? We looked at the different benefits and limitations of the tools based on what we know of the perspectives of like the CARE project officers and others involved with community-based cumulative risk assessments, and developed suggestions for new and improved tools. So slide 8 starts getting into the results. So the results of putting together that list of chemical-related community stressors, which I mentioned again is going to be expanded upon to include other drivers of environmental stressors within a community setting. Well, that list was put together from 10 different references, which include several EPA reports, like reports on the environment or a Science Advisory Board report, the 1999 National Scale Air Toxics Assessment, a few regional assessments across the country, a Region 5 Pacoima in California, and Detroit, Michigan assessment that looked at different environmental stressors, and three different CARE program resources. So again, that's a Community Action for Renewed Environment. And what we found, which is generally intuitive, is that each community is different. They have their own list of environmental concerns. And while there may be some topics that cover many different communities, generally they all have several different issues that are very specific to their community. This list it can be very useful simply as a reference for identifying stressors within a community, as opposed to simply starting from scratch and looking out the window and saying, okay, we're ready to do an assessment, but where do we begin? A list like this can actually provide, you know, a good starting point to say, here are stressors that have been identified by other communities, which ones are we interested in, and, you know, how are we different? Again, this list is being expanded with other initiating factors, such as health risks and primary sources, and so that will actually provide more detailed information. We didn't address non-chemical stressors, but the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council 2004 report addresses them fairly well. And it's also important to remember within a community that there could be emerging issues, such as these PCBs in caulk around old windows, or lead in artificial turf, that really, you know, are just coming into the light as being important drivers and considerations for health risks, and they might need to be considered in more of a focused, again, community setting, which, again, is why, you know, the communities provide such an interesting and informative resource for conducting these risk assessments and informing the risk assessment process, is because they bring up issues like this that need to be addressed in many, but perhaps not all, different areas of the country. So moving on to slide 9, the results of what we found for the GIS tools. The tables describe the features of the different tools, of course, so like the information that they map and the resolution at which they map it, and also which databases they access in order to provide that information. We found that the GIS tools will provide information on things like particulate matter in the air, on regulated facilities, on demographics, and on watersheds. But again, we found many different tools for each, or a different tool for a different issue. There were additional tools that were not specifically EPA tools. For example, scorecard.org does provide a ranking based on different databases of environmental concerns at the community level. And airnow.gov is an interagency website that provides real-time air quality monitoring and information, as well as educational resources for interpreting and presenting that information. Again, this map shows results from the National Scale Air Toxics Assessment, which actually addresses over 100 different air toxics at the county level and actually at the census tract level as well, but this is a national map of benzene concentrations. It also provides information on exposure, on modeled exposure estimates, as well as some cancer risks for the carcinogenic compounds that are more well characterized. So NADA, again, is kind of an example of a tool, and I'll mention this later, but it's an example of a tool that provides a lot of information but is really underutilized in cumulative risk assessments. So the next slide, slide 10, provides results of the what we found for the guidance documents. Again, these are documents that are standalone publications and generally describe a step-by-step process for addressing a particular concern. Some of the examples are they address air toxics, lead, radon, asbestos, and other concerns. And we found that the tables describe the application, the tables describe the application or how these are applied, like to what stressors and some other supporting information, and the audience that they're geared towards. And we actually found that only about a quarter of them are designed for community groups themselves to follow. Some non-EPA guidance documents that are actually very popular by communities and by public health agencies include PACE-EH, which is the Protocol for Assessing Community Excellence in Environmental Health. This is actually quite a powerful tool and very informative. It provides steps for identifying the environmental stressors within a community, and it actually provides a ranking methodology so that communities or public health agencies generally have an idea of which ones are the most important and how they can address them. Thrive is another one. This is a tool for health and resilience in vulnerable environments put out by the Prevention Institute. And this one addresses both environmental and social factors. And these images are just some examples of the covers of some of these documents, A Citizen's Guide to Radon, Community Air Screening How-To Manual, and the Community-Based Environmental Protection Manual, a resource book for protecting ecosystems and communities. These are very informative documents. Some of them can be quite long, over 200 pages in length, which alone might provide a limiting factor for their use. Moving on to slide 11, the results of the databases. Again, these needed to include an online query function. So they needed to be available, but they also needed to be able to be accessed publicly and through the web. They would address multiple or single media. And we found that found that the important things to include in the table were how often the databases were updated, and of course the content or what they describe. So that's what the table describes, as well as where they can be found. One of the primary databases is the EnviroFact Data Warehouse and EnviroMapper. So this houses over 10 different databases and provides a mapping feature for mapping the information. It falls short in the sense of it doesn't provide any sort of interpretive information. Once you have the map of results, it doesn't really say anything about how to interpret or use the information. And again, the National Scale Air Toxics Assessment, that provides mapping features currently at the county level, but it does provide information down to the census tract. It can be downloaded as text files. But also, generally, these databases are found across the agency websites, across EPA websites. So each office of the EPA will kind of have its own databases. So they don't integrate all the databases into a central location or provide resources for integrating the information. Slide 12, the results of the exposure models. The exposure models, again, these... The criteria were that they needed to address the contact between the chemical and the external surface of a person, which would include the skin, the nostrils, or the mouth, etc. So, for example, singularly developed like fate and transport models or dose models were not included in this assessment. The table that we have in the paper describes the objectives of the model, so what it addresses, the inputs required. So of course these exposure models need various inputs like ambient concentrations of air pollutants, the outputs that they provide and their availability. And as a group, the models pretty much cover all the different routes of exposure to pollutants. However, most of the models focus on inhalation. We're also very interested in finding models that included human activity patterns. So like the figure in the bottom left, people spend a lot of time commuting, They spend a lot of time indoors, like at their office or in their home, and of course they spend time outdoors walking around and breathing in the ambient air. So it's very important to consider where a person is in space at a given time in order to determine their level of exposure to a particular pollutant. So that was one of the important considerations we had for the models. However, of course, the models can be quite technical. They require fairly decent training in order to simply collect the inputs and run them. However, there were a few screening-level models that could potentially be used by a less technical audience. And the diagram on the bottom right just shows some of the settings that are required for a standard simulation of a given exposure model. And you can see that there are many different steps and processes involved in running those. So the next slide, slide 13, starts on the discussion of this assessment of current tools. So in terms of their current use, we found that the majority of tools really were not used for community-based assessments. However, that PACE-EH tool that I mentioned was very popular and very useful and informative. The TRI and NEI, so these are the Toxic Release Inventory and National Emissions Inventory, so these are databases that basically describe pollutant sources and concentrations. They were accessed and sometimes used by users with more of a technical background. So, for example, gathering information on local sources of a given pollutant and so that people can see where the pollution is coming from, but generally not used by the wider audience. And again, when I mention wider audience or people using them, I'm also referring to regional officers or researchers working in the community-based risk assessment framework. The non-chemical stressors are generally not addressed by the tools. And again, there's just a general lack of awareness of the available tools, possibly because they're spread across several different websites, possibly because there's generally not so much training or education involved with how to use these tools. But nonetheless, there's generally people kind of just don't know of the universe of tools that's available. So some of the implications of these findings is that community groups often rely on roundtable discussions. So simply gathering in a room and brainstorming about the pollutant issues that might be impacting them. Now, one of the dangers associated with this is the concept of risk perception. So what people perceive as the highest risk may not necessarily be the highest risk. And there are so many issues that can be considered within a community framework that it's often very difficult to prioritize them because of the challenge of gathering information on health effects or predominance within the community or steps on mitigating them. So gathering all this information is very important for determining how to prioritize environmental stressors within a community and basically needs to be incorporated more into the development of new tools. And again, interpreting the results of the currently available tools and presenting the tool output is a significant challenge, especially when presenting the results to a non-technical audience. And that's very important to determine steps and resources required to take action against a given pollutant. So it's very important to make sense of your results. Slide 14, this discusses the intersection between the tools and the current research needs. And what we found is that the issues within a community are basically addressed independently by these different tools. The output formats of the different tools is pretty much incompatible with each other unless you have in technical training. Currently, there's no comparative risk available, so contaminants in drinking water, are they more important than air pollution? There's not really a comparative risk available for something like that. And integrated risk is currently unavailable. So what is the combined risk of these different pollutants on health? Well, the implications of that, this group of tools, again, they cover a fairly wide range of media and pollutants. For example, the GIS tools.
Excuse me, Tim. Sorry to interrupt. Someone has a BlackBerry or some type of cell phone near a phone. Please move it away. It's giving a buzz noise.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the GIS tools, they focus, for example, on air pollution, water, and different facilities, like the EnviroMapper has 10 different tools, and it accesses different databases. The guidance documents, a few of them are geared towards communities, but not many of them, and they're typically focused on a specific issue. The databases, they focus on multimedia, and they're often very data-rich. However, analysis and interpretation can be quite difficult. So again, we cover a range of media and pollutants, but there are certain limitations, which I'll also talk about, which is on the next slide, slide 15. Overall, the benefits and limitations of the tools are given here. The benefits are that, you know, we do have a pretty wide breadth of coverage by the tools. So in the right context and given, you know, fairly decent training or description of methodologies. Can everyone still hear me with the buzzing? All right. Given the wide breadth of coverage, you know, we still can collect a lot of information on a lot of different issues. One of the primary limitations of these tools is that risk ranking or cumulative and integrated risk are really not addressed by pretty much by many of these tools. So this table shows the tools and its primary benefits and limitations that we found through our assessment. The GIS tools are very useful for issue identification and mapping of different issues. However, they are, again, separate tools, and they often provide different types of or formats of outputs, so they're not very compatible across GIS tools. For guidance documents, one of the benefits of guidance documents is actually that some of them do provide an overview of the cumulative risk issue, and of course there are other guidance documents geared specifically towards describing cumulative risk. But even some of the ones that focus on a specific topic also kind of address the broader issue of cumulative risk. So that's good to bring people's awareness to that. But for the most part, they focus on singular issues and not necessarily how to address multiple issues in a step-by-step process, which is actually why PACE-EH is different from those, because it does try to address a lot of different issues and place them into a risk ranking context. In terms of the databases, again, they can be very data-rich, so there can be a lot of information within them, and they can focus on different medias and different pollutants. However, downloading the information, analyzing it, interpreting it, could be very difficult. And providing that information to the community could also be very difficult to do. In terms of the exposure models, they provide a pretty thorough exposure and risk characterization. So you can probably get a pretty good information on kind of the primary exposure or risk drivers within a community if you're using the right model and focusing on the right pollutant. However, they do require a fair amount of technical expertise, as well as environmental inputs such as ambient air concentrations, which can be a very significant undertaking, especially if those measurements are currently unavailable for a given area. So moving on to the next slide, slide 16, based on our findings, you know, we have some suggestions for new and improved tools. In terms of developing the tools, it's very important to gather feedback from the communities, from the project officers, from community-based cumulative risk assessment researchers, in order to gather their feedback throughout the development process. This would allow communities, and the tools should basically allow communities to define the problem. So to go to the tool and say, you know, this is what we're concerned about, what kind of information can you give us? Allow researchers when I say communities, I'll just generally refer to anyone kind of conducting a community-based risk assessment. So it would allow communities to supply their own local knowledge, so to input information into the model that they think is important into the tool, and in order to gather feedback that's very community-specific. And the tool would allow them to interpret results within their local context. So again, kind of, you know, how is our community compared to the rest of the nation? How does our community compare to other communities in terms of, like, what are the important issues? The tool should be transparent. I mean, their science should be obvious and backed up by references and solid methodologies. The tool should be accessible to non-scientists, which kind of generally means anyone with, you know, a fair level of training that would be able to use the different tools. And again, they should be reflective of local input, so kind of targeted to specific areas to address those community-specific needs. They should be targeted to solutions, so not necessarily simply providing information, but, you know, kind of providing, again, the interpretation of results and means to address them, and provide quick and timely output. Some of the primary features that could be included in new tools that provide a challenge for current research are to include the cumulative exposure and risk aspects and the integrated exposure and risk aspects to address some of these non-chemical stressors, such as socioeconomic stressors, behavioral factors of the built environment, and also to address these ecosystem effects, which I personally am learning much more about, and the feedbacks between ecosystems and human health. So slide 17, and we'll start to wrap up here, provides sort of an overview of a tool that we're developing based on our findings. It's a web-based tool. It's called CFIRST, the Community-Focused Exposure and Risk Screening Tool. And it's a web-based outlet for the science and the findings that we're discovering along the way. So it's a web-based tool to assist primarily with identification and prioritization of issues. It's intended to be a one-stop shop to view the best available EPA information at the national or local scale, and to access, once you input your local area, you can access a report on your community-specific characterizations of exposure and risk. And this report, again, kind of puts things in a context. It provides information, general information on susceptible populations, sources, concentrations, exposures, health risks, reduction actions, kind of covers the gamut of these initiating factors. It provides access to fact sheets and other resources that are currently available, including these links to other tools. And we are in the process of automating our tables so that they're not just available as like PDF documents, but sort of as an interactive tool on this CFIRST site, so that people can search for currently available tools more efficiently. And initially, CFIRST is being developed for these project officers working with community partners, because we do have a direct interaction with them. They have a direct interaction with community groups, so we have a very good kind of two-way street going on. But of course, other end users can basically involve anyone working within these initiatives. And this tool, again, is described in more detail at this link, which is the same one before, and it's on the reference slide. So slide 18, this is, just wanted to mention here this reference by Medina Vera et al. This paper actually describes publicly available test kits that could be used basically by anyone to gather more information on environmental stressors. It provides information on screening level measurements. The next step is like quantitative screening methods, where you gather a sample, send it to a lab, and then very refined quantitative methods. So it provides sort of a three-level approach or description of tools and measurement kits that are currently available to gather measurements. So in conclusion, on slide 19, and many of these conclusions have implications, you know, that people can kind of draw for themselves, and I'll mention some of them here. So the tables that we put together, they present an overview based on a comprehensive sample of tools, of these EPA tools, a comprehensive sample of stakeholders from the CARE program, and researchers who we collaborated with all along the way to gather the best feedback. These tables and our findings, they can be used to facilitate a community-based exposure assessment, such as using that list to identify concerns. And now here are some of the things that have some implications. The current tools, they do cover a wide breadth of information, but separately. So the tool like CFIRST tries to draw together that information. They typically don't address cumulative and integrated risk or risk ranking, which also is actually a challenge of just determining the methods for doing that, let alone incorporating them into a useful tool. Compiling information from separate tools is very challenging. They have different output formats, for example. Comparing risks, again, is quite challenging, because how does one compare two different types of risks? Communities are generally unaware of available tools, so providing, you know, more educational or training resources to regional offices or public health facilities could prove to be very important. And to try to address many of these things, we are developing CFIRST, is a user-friendly web-based resource to address these research needs. So slide 20, I would like to acknowledge again, you know, the CARE administrators and the program, the project officers and community members have been invaluable in this research. Matt Lakin in Region 9 has provided such important and valuable feedback, as well as Hank Topper, who is now retired from the CARE program. Miriam Medina Vera is in the EPA, who developed that measurement test kits and provided important feedback all along the way. Steve Graham and Eric Hall were very important in the initial stages of this work, and really everyone who contributed feedback and suggestions. There are just so many people, it's difficult to cover them all on one slide. And finally, slide 21 provides the references that are addressed in the slide presentation here. And I just want to mention that the papers of the for number one and number two on the reference slide, those papers are available at this website. And the tables of all the tools that we assessed are also available at the website. And once the proofs of that paper have been finalized for publication, the paper about the tools will also be available on the website. If anyone wants proofs, I can send them proofs. Just contact me at the information below. And that's it, actually. The rest is just disclaimer, which is required. And thank you very much. So thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Tim. That was an excellent, excellent presentation. And I'll turn things over now to Dr. David Herr to lead the questions. Davey, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. Yeah. Are there any phone questions?
Yes, when do you expect C-FIRST to be ready for application and use?
C-FIRST is an excellent question. I should include that. C-FIRST is not going to be available probably for the actual running version of C-FIRST will probably not be available for another year or so. And that's because a lot of what's going into C-FIRST are really sort of new methodologies for addressing some of these issues. So what's happening is it's taking time to actually develop, you know, the scientific approaches that we need to incorporate into C-FIRST. However, we do have, we are currently having a beta version of C-FIRST being reviewed by, like, CARE project officers to get initial stages of feedback. But in terms of the content of C-FIRST and its applicability, it's really not going to be available for another year. However, you know, I am trying to actually work on providing some of this information, for example, like the automated version of these tools. If possible, I'd like to get that available as soon as possible, because that's really just kind of a user-friendly database, you know, where people can find at least the current tools that are available. So someone can select, oh, I'm interested in air, you know, air pollution, and then it would simply give out the list of currently available tools for air pollution. So hopefully features like that will be available in the short term, but I would say check back at the link on the references table to find out on the updates of C-FIRST as it becomes available, but it may not be for another year or so.
Anything else on the phone lines?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
This is Marty Berth, Alaska DEC, and I'm aware that there are a lot of tools available, but are there efforts underway to encourage coordination of the use of a specific tool between agencies, the communities, because comparing risks from the various tools is certainly a challenge that we face.
Can you say that question kind of one more time, please?
For instance, is there some sort of effort to encourage collaborative efforts about what tool is appropriate for use, so that you don't get a community that receives a grant to do research, and they come up with this risk estimate. But it's not. It may or may not have been a tool that other agencies, state or federal agencies, may have chosen or selected, so we get a different risk answer. And so then you have two answers, and who's right?
Oh, that
kind of situation.
I'm really currently not aware of collaborative efforts that address that specifically, although that's a very interesting consideration. There are... No, I'm not really aware of that per se. It seems like there's more of a focus on, you know, addressing these research needs and making the information on currently available tools available. But yeah, what is the right tool for the job that would kind of be widely accepted and provide the best available information? I think that's a very doable step and should really be included in this assessment, actually. So I'll take a closer look at that myself, too.
This is Charles Royce. I'd like to just sort of throw in there also the person from Alaska who's having this conflict between the different tools. The answer may lie in trying to evaluate the intent and intended applications of the two dueling tools to try to determine which one is actually a better fit for the specific community that is being assessed. And I know that's not the complete answer. It's just an idea for one path to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times different tools are used for different applications, and some of those applications the tool never really was intended for.
Mm-hmm.
And can, you know, in a when you're stuck, you might be able to use it, but it would take a secondary importance.
Mm-hmm. I think this also addresses the question of, you know, what is an accepted methodology for sort of performing a risk assessment. So, like to date, you know, some of these tools may not guide you through the whole process, but actually provide the information to conduct an assessment. So in that sense, you know, the question is also becomes, so is there a description or a methodology to follow to gather information from different tools to address a particular need, and you know, how can that be done rigorously and accurately too? So even developing like a methodology and interpretation guidelines would help to address that as well.
Mm-hmm.
This is Kathy and Arlene from Minnesota. I'm wondering if you've taken a look at rural versus urban so that you're sure you're picking up some of the rural issues?
Well, in a sense, we have, and that's covered in a bit more detail in the survey paper that's coming out. We kind of separated the environmental issues by urban and rural to see which ones were of particular concern to different types of communities, and we did try to incorporate the different stressors or areas of concern from the different types into the assessment of tools. However, the assessment itself did not necessarily separate the tools into urban and rural classifications, but we did try to distinguish between urban and rural stressors. Yeah.
Anything else from the phone lines?
Sure, I have a question.
Okay.
My name is Yolanda Sanchez. I'm a fellow at the Environmental Protection Agency. And my question is, how do you compare risks when they're so different versus, for example, a high risk of morbidity versus a high risk of mortality?
If I could answer that question, I'd probably be much farther along than I am right now. But that I think is one of the big challenges is how to compare risks and even kind of on a more simple level, like I mentioned before, the environmental sort of indexes of, you know, how do we even just compare the risk of drinking water to the risk of air pollution? It's a very challenging question, and I think it's my best answer, and probably maybe others can expand, but my best answer is kind of like it is a current research area, and how do we compare those? it's very difficult, really. And I'm not exactly sure I know the specific answer to that question. That's my best answer, I think.
No, that's fine. I was wondering if you were pulling from any psychological research on risk assessment.
Yeah, no, but that's, yeah, even in terms of the morbidity-mortality comparison, that's a very, very, I don't know. I'm not exactly sure how you would really compare those risks, and I guess I would consider, in a sense, looking at the drivers for morbidity and mortality and seeing the commonalities or differences between them, and then assessing the comparative risks between those drivers, as opposed to the end effects, in a sense. But yeah, that's a very good question.
Okay, Chuck, there's some online questions that would be best done answered by email. How can we handle those?
I think Tim's email on the Kluwen website?
It is on slide 21. If it's not on the website, it is on slide 21.
Okay, and it would be barzik.timothy@epa.gov.
Right, barzik.timothy@epa.gov, and I'll spell that. It's barzyk.timothy@epa.gov.
Okay.
Also, we are going over the hour here, so...
There's one more question
I would welcome folks to sign off if they need to, and we'll just continue on with whoever can stay on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's one more question that just came in from Robin Schaefer of the EPA in Washington. Hang on. And it says, apart from developing a new tool like CFIRST, who is working to improve existing tools so that they work together and automatically compile responses, like kayak.com does for all low-cost airfare tools, thereby reducing overlap and confusion? If no one is doing this, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And then this would address some of your concerns on slide 19. However, the issue of risk assessment would remain open.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm not aware of anyone really bringing together the current state of the tools. Based on our research, just in terms of compiling these tables and bringing together the information from these different tools, you know, we found that we were some part of the only groups that were really even just finding out what's available across the EPA's websites. Bringing them into a central location, I think, is the first step, and that's what we're trying to do here. And then, you know, formatting and integrating them is going to be a significant challenge because they are all housed in, like, different offices, for example. So one would have to really bring together all of those different offices and individuals and ask them to sort of reformat the tools in order to make them compatible. So, you know, again, this is kind of the first step in looking at the current state of the tools, and I'm not aware really of anyone bringing together and reformatting them or reformatting their output to make them more compatible, which, you know, I think would be very valuable. Just to make their output formats compatible would be extremely valuable.
Can I ask, this is Sarah Levinson in Region 1, it seems that I'm trying to ascertain whether or not your effort is just summarizing all the tools that are out there, or whether it's actually going to give you some direction as to which tool can maybe integrate these exposures that are coming in. And I'm looking at Medina Vera's paper, and I see tables of, you know, exposure models that are out there in web addresses, but they are very specific to a particular pollutant via a particular pathway.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, I mean, we're trying to do cumulative assessments from not just one medium or one pollutant, but all media and all pollutants.
Right.
So are you finding a lack of information out there, or is that what CFIRST will be addressing when it's finished? Mm-hmm. Or
that's the goal of CFIRST.
Okay.
It really is to bring together this information and provide the resources that are required to provide a more cumulative assessment. Currently, the idea is to draw from sort of available databases to compile the information. So in terms of the report that CFIRST would generate, it would cover sort of all of the issues of concern for a community and, provide information about them. In that sense, anyway, we're working sort of more on compiling the information, providing like it in a context, and focusing on sort of the prioritization of environmental concerns as much as possible, especially as they relate to health risks.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that it's a challenge now for CFIRST and for the field in general to develop how do we present this information in a cumulative way. And or in a comparative way, the risk ranking process is very difficult, and really providing any information in the sense of a publicly available tool that provides a risk ranking approach and methods for addressing them, we just have to make sure that it's pretty very very sound. One of our main goals is really to provide the information to allow the communities or the researchers to make an informed decision about how they can best handle their highest risks. Does that address your question?
Well, it partially does, because I'm still troubled, I guess, but if you have benzene and you've got stationary monitors picking it up from automobile sources, let's say, and then you've got a benzene exposure in the home itself from cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
and you may have it in the water or other media, I'm just wondering, it seems to me that we actually have to get to the level not only of the exposure that's being integrated across space and time, but the internal dose that's going to be received in order to estimate the risk that's been projected for that receptor or group of receptors. And so to me, I don't know how you can get to the priority setting. You can set it based on an exposure, benzene via stationary source monitors, but if that's dwarfed by the cigarette contribution in the home,
right.
Your priority setting is going to be misdirected, or your interventions might possibly be misdirected.
Right.
Yeah,
and I think in that example, one would focus on kind of the local community information that can be provided. So for a stressor like benzene, there could be an assessment of, how many roadways are in your area, what are the major industrial benzene sources, and what are the smoking rates, and then, possibly provide information on how each of those contribute to benzene exposure and associated risks. At least that would draw, in a sense, on the sort of available information or community-based inputs that could sort of help to at least identify the main drivers of it, and then present information on how one can mitigate kind of like each of those drivers in its own way.
Okay, thanks.
Is there anything else out? Anyone else out there?
This is Charles Maurice in EPA in Chicago. Tim, you mentioned a few times on several of your slides, you separated cumulative risk and integrated risk. And I was wondering, and they are different, I was just wondering if you could give just a brief explanation of how you differentiate between the two.
Sure.
Your perspective on that.
Okay, yeah, I'm happy to provide my perspective. I'm not sure if it's the one endorsed by everybody else, but my perspective on cumulative and integrated risk is when I think of cumulative risk, I think of sort of that list again, like what are all the things that are impacting say, a given geographic area. And to me, a geographic area is a community because it involves the population that lives within it and their specific concerns. So I see cumulative risk as covering sort of like all the pollutants, all the media, all the non-chemical stressors, just kind of everything, the cumulative, just everything that's kind of impact, could potentially be impacting health of people or ecosystems. To me, cumulative risk is a very broad definition. It includes a lot of different things. In that respect, a lot of different components, pollutants, sources, et cetera. To me, integrated risk is looking at those different stressors and finding a way to assess their contribution to health effects in a combined way. So actually adding up the risks associated with the different stressors. This might be something related to a particular health effect like radon and smoking. For example, their synergistic effects on lung cancer, for example. But it can also be, well, air pollutants in air, drinking water, food, and psychosocial stressors. If you can integrate their risks to a particular health effect, so to me, integrated risk, in a sense of conceptually thinking about it, is kind of focused on a particular health risk. And how does one add up? So one might know the cancer risk of benzene, but what about like benzene, you know, plus different aldehydes or something? How might they all work together to provide an adverse health outcome? So again, cumulative is kind of the universe of things, and integrated is kind of what are their combined effects on health.
Thank you.
If there's no other questions, I guess that about sums things up for today's seminar.
Well, thanks everyone for the opportunity. Feel free to email or contact me with any questions or additional information.
And our next seminar in this series will be in 2 weeks from today, same time, and same phone number, same Clouin website, and we will be addressing tribal perspectives on cumulative risk assessment. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Bye.